retreating from the graveyard of empires after 20 marathon years, shouldn't they be held accountable for wreaking havoc in the country?
Should the United States be held accountable for its crimes in Afghanistan? The U.S., in the pursuit of this mission, committed numerous war crimes against the Afghan people. Should it be held accountable for these and for its acts of aggression? Yes, absolutely. Will it be? No, absolutely not. United States is a member of the UN Security Council, a permanent member, two of its partners for its military occupation of Afghanistan. The United Kingdom and France are also permanent members of the Security Council. And currently, under international law, there really exists no mechanism to hold a permanent member of the Security Council accountable because of their veto power over, not only the International Criminal Court, but the UN Security Council itself. So they will ultimately not be. The only hope for that is the Court of American Public Opinion, and unfortunately that is even less likely.
One last question, sir. Now, with Taliban firmly in control, do you see any role for the U.S. in Afghanistan from now on?
Well, the Taliban is not firmly in control of Afghanistan. First of all, there does remain some political and possibly military resistance in the Panjshir Valley. And this is centered around the figures of the, until recently, U.S.-installed regime vice president Saleh, who is a figure who has worked closely with the Central Intelligence Agency in the past, and the figure Ahmed Massoud, whom, of course, is the son of his famous Jamhuriyat father. And he is being used as a figurehead by those who seek some type of military resistance in northern Afghanistan, to echo the long Northern Alliance resistance to the Taliban 1.0. But perhaps ultimately the further U.S. role in Afghanistan will be one of spoiler. If they can't control the country, they will make sure that they economically strangle the Taliban, and so doing will try to destabilize the country. Once again, because they fear that Russia and China and Iran, seeking stability in the region and a pathway for the Belt and Road and other economic initiatives, will move into the country. That, of course, does not mean militarily, but it means trying to shore up, a new Taliban government economically. The U.S. will attempt to strangle that with sanctions, with control of the IMF. They've already frozen the Afghan state's international reserves, currency reserves, and they will do everything possible to strangle the economy of an Afghanistan ruled by the Taliban in an attempt to continue to destabilize the situation. If they can't control it, they will want it destabilized for the surrounding Eurasian powers.
Mr. Sloboda, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the turn of events in war-ravaged Afghanistan and the disastrous U.S. legacy.
U.S.-based historian and podcaster Ali Olumi says Taliban took advantage of the system built by the U.S. in Afghanistan, based on corruption, bribes and payoffs. Ben Norton, a journalist and filmmaker based in Latin America, notes that Americans were not in Afghanistan for nation building, but to exploit its rich mineral resources. European Parliament Mick Wallace asserts that the US-NATO project in Afghanistan was designed to enrich the military-industrial complex at the cost to Afghans. American journalist Kurt Millis quotes from an article by a former U.S. Marine in which he accuses the U.S. politicians, elites and military leaders of lying about Afghanistan for 20 years. Hu Shijin, a Chinese journalist, notes that defeat in Vietnam buried the American leadership and Kabul did it again, warning that Asia will turn into super graveyard of the U.S. empire.
And that was our episode on the ignominious end to America's longest war in Afghanistan and the disastrous legacy it leaves in the war-ravaged country after 20 long years of military occupation. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
We tried to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
One of the qualities of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is the quality of basira. If Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas did not see where it is necessary to use this, at what point and when not to use it, that great skill of Abbas, the bravery of Abbas, would not have been glowing the way it is. The reason why Abbas shines up to today, Qamaru Bani Hashim still shines, is not because the skill by itself. Let me give you another example. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya is the brother of Abbas. They're both children of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Haydar al-Karrar. Amir al-Mu'mineen trained Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya as well. Look at the lines Amir al-Mu'mineen has to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya. Really, by the way, very nice lines that we need to look at on a different topic, address that and learn from it. Amir al-Mu'mineen in the Battle of Siffin gives the flag, gives the banner to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya and says, you see the end of Muawiyah's camp? The end of it. We're facing all these 75,000 soldiers that Muawiyah has brought from Sham. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, you see the end of it? Aim for that. Don't aim for the few guys here. You're going way out there. And then one of the lines Amir al-Mu'mineen has to him is, A'irillah jumjumatek, the skull of yours, which represents life. He says, give this as a trust to Allah. I'm giving it to you. And it's interesting, Amir al-Mu'mineen uses the word A'irillah. I'ara is something you give, you take back. In other words, when you're going and fighting for Allah, while you want shahada, while you want to be killed in the way of Allah, you want to complete the task. God, I'm giving this to you. You protect this till I get to the end of the army of the enemies. Amir al-Mu'mineen trains Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya as well. They're both the children of Ali ibn Abi Talib. They share the blood of Ali ibn Abi Talib. In those battles, what's been recorded, this great bravery, chivalry. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya, besides the nafsani problems, besides the issues that clearly he had, that Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas didn't, so pure, As-salamu alayk, ayyuha al-abdu al-salih, al-muti' lillah. Read his ziyarah when you go over there to Karbala. We've been taught to say this, ayyuha al-abd al-salih, the servant of Allah, the reformed, the good servant and slave of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Al-muti' lillah, who's obedient. The nafsani issues aside, In his conversation with Imam al-Hussein, we're talking about this judgment of the conditions. That is what will help with the basira. Right now the focus is basira itself. Look at the conversation of Imam al-Hussein with Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah. And look at the lack of conversation, as far as we know. I have not seen any record of Imam al-Hussein even wanting to talk to Abbas that you should come, and then him saying, well, let me think about it. He's not a child. Although, as we said, even the children of Karbala didn't come without thinking, without knowing, without understanding. But Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is a grown man. He knows what he's doing. He thinks. There's no conversation. He came along without having to be spoken to. Not only did he not object, he didn't even have to be spoken to. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah looks at the conditions. He understands where the Ahlul Bayt come from. He's from that physical house. He's not one of the Ahlul Bayt in either the sense of the Ma'sumin or the sense that Abul Fadl al-Abbas is. If we have hadith that Salman minna Ahlul Bayt, Abul Fadl al-Abbas is beyond that. He's definitely of the Ahlul Bayt, but not of the 14 Ma'sumin. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah is not on that level, but he's physically in the house. He's seen things. He knows. He's heard Amir al-Mu'mineen. He was part of the struggle in the 5 years of governance of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He saw what happened with Imam al-Mujtaba. He didn't oppose that. He's been in this house. He's known the plans of the Ahlul Bayt, Imam al-Mujtaba, Imam al-Hussein. He's known all of that. Now the time comes, the plan that was known, that when Muawiyah dies, we have got to make a move. Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah looks at the conditions. What's his judgment? This is what basira is, understanding the conditions that you're in. His judgment is, rising now will lead to nothing but death. What does this mean? It means there's no outcome. There's no positive result. There's no reason. It's spilling one's blood in vain. In other words, suicide. It's suicide. His judgment of the conditions is suicide. You're going to go out there. I understand what you're saying. I agree with you. Obviously, I don't agree with Yazid. I don't think they should be in power. I fought these people in Siffin myself. But what are we supposed to do towards them? Are these the times when everybody has pledged allegiance during the life of Muawiyah to Yazid? They have gained control over all these regions. They've expanded their territory, the riches at their disposal, people listening to them. It's worse than the time of Siffin. In Siffin, we were 45,000 people against 75,000 people. Now you don't have 45,000 people, you don't even have 1,000 people. If you go out, perhaps he's even thinking the following. Imam al-Mujtaba signed a treaty, you were with him. At those times, you had more than a few hundred people that would follow you. They would go and fight Muawiyah. You had more than a few thousand. Yeah, sure, Muawiyah had 70, 80, I don't know, whatever number of thousands of soldiers. The Ahlul Bayt, you had 1,000 soldiers, 2,000 soldiers, 3,000 soldiers. Now you don't have any of that. If you go out, you refuse to pledge allegiance to Yazid, and you decide to rise against him, if you do that, it will result in nothing but spilling your blood, and that means suicide. Don't put your life in danger with no results. Sure, if there is in a battlefield, again, using arguments that perhaps he's thinking, I was in Siffin, I risked my life, but it's a risk that's worthy. I may get killed, but with these numbers, we can win this battle. We would get rid of Muawiyah, get rid of the problem. You have an army, it makes sense. Those who die, they become shaheed. That's shahada. But if you go now, there'll be no outcome. They'll just kill you, massacre you, no result. Take your family as... This is his judgment. These are his words, not with all the extra explanations I give. I'm trying to elaborate. I'm giving you a commentary on the words that Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah has spoken to Imam al-Husayn, salamullah alayhi. The judgment of Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah in these conditions as someone that's part of this camp. He's not someone... The reason why we say we focus on an individual like this and we talk about his flaws is for us to learn from, because he was from this camp. We're not talking about someone that's outside of this camp. We're not talking about Marwan ibn Hakam the Mal'un, who was trying to convince the governor of Medina to kill Imam al-Husayn right there. We're talking about Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyyah. He's a Sayyid beyond what usually we call Sayyid. He's the direct son of Ali ibn Abi Talib. He's been in that camp. But look at his judgment of these conditions. Obviously, Imam al-Husayn's judgment of the condition is different. Imam al-Husayn's judgment of Yazid, his judgment of the conditions of the Ummah, the judgment of the measures that need to be taken and will give the results and bear the fruits of reviving the Sunnah of the Prophet, his judgment is that actually this is the time to rise. Whether we are able to get a few thousand people to fight along our side against the governor of Kufa or some other governor somewhere else, or we don't and we are massacred. The judgment of Imam al-Husayn is, at this time, unlike the time of Imam al-Mujtaba and the Treaty of Muawiyah, at this time, if they massacre us, we win. If they take our family as prisoners of war, we win. If we're left alone, we win. Obviously, if we're not left alone, we win. That wasn't something that there was a dispute. He knew. But both their judgments was that we won't get enough support. Imam al-Husayn knew that. He was more clever. But the judgment is here. If we don't get that support and they massacre us, his judgment is it'll be in vain. It's suicide. Imam al-Husayn's judgment is what? It won't be in vain. It'll save Islam. That's Imam al-Husayn's judgment.
Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah,
who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadiri, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Broadcasting to you as usual from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today's question is an interesting one, to say the least. And the pose of the question says, as you know, the battle that took place on the day of Ashura was near the Euphrates River. Nowhere on earth can you find a land by a river that is a desert and completely grassless, except a river that, for example, runs through the mountains because of rocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. We have all read throughout our education, our lives as Muslims, or not necessarily Muslims, we have read that plains and fertile lands always follow along rivers because of the water that is present there. Naturally, the fact is that the Euphrates, like other rivers, plains and fertile lands around the Euphrates, like Karbala, for example, there is greenery and vegetation, saying that Karbala is then covered by this greenery because there is a presence of water. Moreover, in such areas, due to the proximity to the river, the groundwater bed also forms vast aquifers. And access to water is easier than one might think. You just have to dig in the ground to get some water. Like, for example, you can maybe just be digging 4 or 5 meters to reach this groundwater. And the pose of this question mentions that in the region of Ahwaz in Iran, one of the problems actually that construction workers face when building is this very vast underground aquifer that has completely covered the city. Knowing this, couldn't then the 72 companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam then just have dug a simple 4 meter pit and then constructed a well and then have solved their problems?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are a couple of points that I need to mention answering this question. First of all, maybe the poser of this question, they haven't been in Karbala or in the land like Karbala, because
right. There
are many cases in which you have a river and just few kilometers away from that river you have a complete desert without any water, without
exactly. Any
tree, without it's not a fruitful plain anymore, it's just a desert. And right now, even if these people study about the city of Karbala, it's not the case that because of the fact that it's not very close to Euphrates, but it's not the case that Karbala is one of the green cities of the world because it's close to Euphrates.
Exactly.
Not at all. And it's not only Karbala. In many cities which are called desert, they may have a river few kilometers away from them. The poser of the question mentioned Iran. The same is true about many cities in Iran. Let's talk about Qom, for example. In some of the places, around the city of Qom, you have green trees for 1 kilometer. And then after that, you have kilometers of desert without any tree.
Right.
So we shouldn't think that, it's a misunderstanding regarding the city of Karbala, the desert of Karbala. All the people call it a desert.
Exactly.
And there is an interesting narration, for example, the narrator talk about Imam Adi alayhi salam coming from the Battle of Siffin, and then they reached the desert of Karbala. So there is no tree, there is no water. It's only a desert.
Right.
And Imam alayhi salam talks about the future. He predicts about the fact that his son Imam Hussein alayhi salam will be killed. And in all the narrations, in many narrations in which the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is mentioned, they talk about the desert. They do not talk about a jungle, for example, right. Or
the humid jungles and the trees and the greenery.
That's the point. So this is a false understanding of the geographical conditions of the place.
Exactly. I would liken it to a farm. Have you seen a farm in Qom, for example, or in a desert area? Where there's water, which the farmer himself gives to these plants, there are plants.
Yeah.
But you go literally like 15 centimeters
exactly.
to any other direction, there is nothing.
Nothing.
It is true that there is a river, but this river doesn't go through the entire area of Karbala.
Yeah.
Or if the poser has ever seen the Nile River in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
Egypt is also
yeah.
basically mostly of it a desert. It's not right covered line, by greenery.
Yeah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So this is the first point. The second point is also related to, geographical conditions. That is the fact that to think that when you have a river, then like, for example, 15 kilometers from that river, if you dig the ground, you will reach water after 4 or 5 meters. This is another, misconception. In many cases, people can check it with the, scientific data on that.
Right.
In some cases, you need to, I'm talking about Iran, when you go to the north, there are places not that far from the Caspian Sea, but you need to dig as long as 35 meters to reach water. So this is, again, a misunderstanding that if you have a closed river, then, as soon as you dig 4 or 5 meters, you will reach water. No,
the water source is not infinite of this river.
Yeah. And in many cases, when you dig 4 or 5 meters, you will reach water. But after a few hours, it will finish. And you need to wait a couple of hours for water again. So let's talk about what happened, practically speaking, in Karbala. We know that before that, let me refer to a reality which many people may neglect. And that is the fact that we are talking about, the desert, a desert with, in a very hot day. I'm not sure if people have been in Iraq even in summer. Even in summer, you cannot walk in the city a couple of hours under sun. After
you can't.
Few minutes, you need water.
Yeah.
So we are talking about the month of Muharram. Of course, it was around the month of Mehr in Iran, which is the first of autumn, but still, in autumn, if you go to Karbala, you cannot walk in the streets, in the bazaar for a couple of hours.
You need shade.
Yeah, you need shade. So let's imagine that Imam, it's wrong, but for the sake of the argument, let's imagine that Imam Hussein alayhi salam and all the family members, they had water all these 10 days. But we're talking about fighting. On the 10th of Ashura, when people are fighting, even if there is no access to water for half an hour or for 1 hour, you get thirsty very soon.
Of course.
People are under the, it's a very hot day, and they are fighting. Let me give you the example of sports. For example, Olympics, you see that after 3 minutes of wrestling, the people, they need water.
Give them a break.
Yeah. And nowadays, in soccer also, in some places where the, it's a hot day, after 30 minutes, we have the cooling break, for example. And from time to time, people come and drink water. So even if they're, imagine that they have had access to water, imagine that only on the day of Ashura they did not have access to water because they are fighting, and they are fighting. They are not able to go to Euphrates and come back and bring water to the camp. So within that, even 3-4 hours, you will get thirsty, and that's a reality. So we shouldn't think that even if they have had access to water for the whole 10 days, on the day of Ashura they were not thirsty. No, I mean, if you do not have access to water, if a 6-month baby doesn't have access to water on that hot day, after half an hour he or she will feel thirsty and they need water. So having said that, we go to the historical books. According to the history, Imam Hussein alayhi salam for 7 days they had access to water, and although for some occasions they need to fight the enemy to have access to water, but it did not lead to a very serious conflict. But from the 7th day, Umar ibn Sa'd commanded the army to prevent Imam Hussein alayhi salam's camp from reaching the Euphrates. So Umar ibn Sa'd commanded a person called Amr ibn Hajjaj Zubaydi to protect from the river with 500 people. So in these 3 days, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions, if they wanted to reach the Euphrates, they needed to have a serious conflict with the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, and it happened in many cases.
Right.
But for 3 days, they did not have, free and direct access to water. They need to fight for that. So within these 3 days, it was not necessary for Imam to dig a well, because through fighting, they could have access to water.
And I might just add, even if they had access to water, they would need a lot of water. I remember reading soldiers who went to Afghanistan or Iraq or hot regions, they were ordered every single day to at least drink 10 liters of water per person. And now you need to imagine the camp of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his supporters who numbered 72 people, and the family of Imam Hussein who needed these 10 liters of water every single day at the very least. And they went around carrying their equipment, their shields, their helmets, their steel or iron swords. It was very tough to just move around.
Yeah, Imam Hussein alayhi salam were about, according to some estimations, about 200 people. So each of them, if they need 10 liters of water,
you do the math.
Yeah, 2,000 liters of water each day. And that's another point. Each time it's been mentioned in the narrations that they could bring 20, water skins from the Euphrates. But
only.
After fighting, they are able only to bring 20 water skins or 30. So is it enough for 200 people for 2-3 days? Of course not.
And not about on the horses as well.
Yeah,
the war horses.
We have the horses as well. So then we come to why Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not dig a well. So for 3 days they need to fight to go to the Euphrates, and they did in some cases, but they were only able to bring a few water skins. When it comes to digging a well, there are some explanations that I think we need to talk about in the following session.
Inshallah. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your time, and I thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي لعلي وحسين وحسن حب آل البيت فرض
Economic Divide.
The story of Afghanistan has been front page news for quite some time, and rightly so. In one respect, it shows how waging a war, occupation, and a retreat can destroy a country. And that is what the U.S. and its NATO partners have done. Hi, I'm Kavitah Wayan, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at Afghanistan's economy and where it's going to be headed to next, what's left of it, under the Taliban. The exorbitant U.S. spending in the Afghan war, $2.26 trillion. Corruption, waste, unfinished projects, and an expense that will continue for quite some time, even after the U.S. pullout. And that's in the form of interests. Was it worth it? Also, we're going to take a look at the Afghan economy under the Taliban. What was the economy before they took control? And what will be their source of revenues? Will they discontinue their opium sales? Our in-depth section will cover that. And then we will take a look at what Afghanistan prides itself in terms of its products and commodity, and that is its wealth minerals. China has practically welcomed the Taliban with open arms. Is that due to the One Belt, One Road project, or with an eye on Afghanistan's mineral wealth?
The U.S. war in Afghanistan has ended after 20 years. The U.S. president justified his withdrawal.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way.
The current cost, to date, $2.261 trillion. This is the breakdown. The DOD, largest spending, $933 billion. The interest, a staggering $530 billion, something the U.S. has to continue paying even after the war has ended. But what does the U.S. have to show for it? It's called SIGAR, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, created by U.S. Congress to provide independent and objective oversight of Afghanistan reconstruction projects and activities. Report after report, the naked truth was revealed. Shocking. Corruption and waste were rampant. The latest report confirmed more or less what the previous reports revealed. Titled, What We Need to Learn, Lessons from 20 Years of Afghanistan Reconstruction, it concluded the U.S. failed to implement a coherent strategy in over 20 years. It did not understand the Afghan context and failed to tailor its efforts accordingly. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding. We did not know what we were doing. Many of the institutions and infrastructure projects the U.S. had built were not sustainable or even usable.
To me, it's billions of dollars that probably have been wasted. We've built schools that are falling down. We've built clinics that there are no doctors for. We've built roads that are falling apart.
Some examples of this waste. Tarakhil Power Plant, $335 million. Used but not as intended and in a deteriorated condition. The Wardak National Police Training Center, $98 million. Used as intended, but deteriorated. The most critical failure, the Afghan Army. $88.3 billion spent for training and equipping.
When you take a look at the Afghan economy, it wasn't a functioning economy based on, for example, supply and demand. There were other factors which spurred economic activity. Afghanistan is extremely poor, landlocked, and highly dependent on foreign aid. Corruption, insecurity, weak governance, lack of infrastructure pose challenges to future economic growth. The Afghan economy sustained nearly a decade of strong growth, international assistance, which pledged around $86.8 billion. The country's gross domestic product, estimated at $22 billion, has grown nearly threefold since the Taliban were driven from power back in 2001. According to the World Bank, three-fourths of the government's budget is funded by international donors. Well, the state of the economy, even with international assistance, was so weak that 90% of the population lives on less than $2 a day. That's according to the former president, Ashraf Ghani. Our guest joining us for this edition of the program, in this segment, is Muhammad Daoud Avedi. He's the chairman of the Afghan Nation Peace Council. He was previously a spokesman and a negotiator for the Hizb Islami group. Okay, welcome, Muhammad Daoud. You are aware about the situation as it's unfolding in Afghanistan. Since the year 2001, the U.S. has spent, it's estimated, $2.226 trillion. That has yielded a chaotic, humiliating end to America's longest war, because really the money is under question as to where it went. Corruption has been stated from both the U.S. and Afghan side. You have unfinished projects. So the question is, where did this money go? Why did that not get spent wisely in that country?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for your invitation. The money that U.S. and other nations spent in Afghanistan were split in different ways, and was spent in different ways. Some were, most big chunk of it were spent for military purposes, their own military, to come and fight the Afghans. It was not for the rebuild of Afghanistan or building structures in Afghanistan that could benefit the Afghan people in Afghanistan as a whole. A very big chunk of this was spent through the war. But the portion that was spent through the Afghan government in the NGOs, non-government organizations, that money that was spent in these two sectors was split again into two. Some were given to the NGOs and some were given to the Afghan government.
Okay, we appreciate that. Thank you, Muhammad Daoud, for that. Now, as you indicated, their money was misused and misappropriated, and nothing is more evident of that, in this case in point, than what was called Afghanistan's ghost money. Now, this ghost money is in reference to a tactic that was used by the CIA to get money to Afghanistan. It's time now for our info news section, where we take a look at news which may not be that up to date, but worth taking a look at, especially for one of our future programs. Our first story comes out of Haiti. Haiti was hit by a massive earthquake recently, which devastated parts of the island. In terms of the casualty figures, over 1,200 lives were lost. This comes after the assassination of its president, and as a consequence, now the economy has taken a beating. Haiti, with a population of 11 million, is considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Next story, U.S.-China trade. Haven't taken a look at that in a while. When it comes to trade tensions between the two, the U.S. better think twice about how much pressure it's exerting on China. The U.S.-China trade war is hurting America more than actually China. Trump's unprecedented tariffs and technology war with China, which is now passed on to Biden, is costing the U.S. economy, causing disruption to crucial supply chains and wild swings in prices overall. Next up, fake drugs, counterfeit drugs. They've always been a problem. One report revealed fake medicine now kills upwards of the figure that you're about to see here, which is quite astounding when you think about it in terms of the deaths. 1 million people, that's per year. Wonder how much that is every day. It's quite a bit. That's according to the World Health Organization. And that's five times actually more people that die than narcotics. I mean, the trade in fake drugs has proliferated so much during COVID that it has eclipsed the market which has cocaine, heroin, and cannabis in it. So that's leading to more deaths than those illegal drugs. And our final look is at U.S. food stamps. This program in the U.S., the U.S. president just announced the biggest increase to the food stamps ever. Starting in October, food assistance benefits will increase by an average, which is one of its largest in its history, if not the largest, 25%. So the people receiving the food assistance are going to be happy to hear that. Average benefit, which was $121 before COVID, will now increase by $36 a month. Sounds good, but is it because the economy is not doing well for many Americans? It's something to think about. Okay, it's time now for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but we'll be right back after a quick pause.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Now that the Taliban have overtaken Afghanistan, how are they going to make sure that they have an operational economy? Well, these are some of the questions that sooner rather than later they have to deal with. For example, how are they going to run a finance ministry and also a central bank? Central bank is obviously very key. As of now, the U.S. has actually blocked close to $9 billion of its money overseas. They're not going to let the Taliban access it, so that's going to be a very key question. Next up, how will foreign donors actually be able to trust them with aid? Now, the aid for Afghanistan is something that happens on a yearly basis. Many countries around the world contribute to Afghanistan because, obviously, it's a country that's been racked with wars, years of wars. So that's a very key question there also. And then the next question, since many of them are sanctioned, many Taliban members, how will they access the world financial system? I mean, that's really important. They need to transfer money. They need to have money coming in. How is that going to happen? I mean, as of this point, there isn't a system of governance in place in that country yet, at least as of the recording of this program. However, this is what a senior Taliban leader, his name is Wahidullah Hashemi, has said.
In future, this is not up to now discussed. How it would be. Maybe we have a council, the head of the council, as you call the president, we would call that Rais al-Wazara or the head of the council, and we will have ministers. All the ministers would be appointed by this council and by the head of the council.
Well, that's what he has said. Well, to begin with, generating income is going to be very important to the Taliban. That answer may come in the form of what is called the informal economy. Now, the informal economy has large amounts of hidden money in the war zone. First off, opiates, as you see here, trafficking in opium, hashish, methamphetamines, and other narcotics is set to bring the Taliban revenues of anywhere between $500 to $600 million yearly. Not bad, is it? Now, since they came to power, they have vowed not to continue this illegal trade. But the biggest kind of trade that happens, the real money, comes from another area that is not that well known. That is money which comes from the illegal movement of ordinary goods. Now, it consists of things like fuel and also consumer imports. So these are the goods that are flowing in through this, what we call informal economy, which is the illegal movement of goods in this case. In size and sum, the informal economy dwarfs international aid, which again flows into Afghanistan on a yearly basis. Now, let's take a look at that source of income, which is called the informal taxation. You have the informal economy and then the formal taxation. Fees for passage of goods is what I'm talking about here. This is the collection of fees by armed personnel, the Taliban, to allow safe passage of the goods. The money produced from this taxation, $235 million annually. Now, one of the largest income producers came from an area by the name of Zaranj. That's actually a city bordering Iran. Now, this city provided the government with roughly, again, these are rough numbers, $43.2 million in terms of annual duties. Also, an additional $50 million in direct taxes for the year 2020. There was also a significant amount of undeclared trade, particularly of fuel. total revenues from this border crossing, $176 million per year. Now, the total amount of trade through all of Afghanistan's border crossings, that needs to be looked at. Here's a map of that. The border crossings are the ones in the green. You can see them here and here. That's the ranch that I just talked about. You have one over here, Ten Gural, which is over there. And you have about four or five more. Now, these revenues are estimated to be $2 billion per year. So you can see the money generated there is quite a bit. Now, once informal trade is included, that figure is going to be actually twice as high. Well, at this point, Afghans are definitely very worried about the chain of events that happened in their country with the collapse of the government. The Afghan money is quickly losing its value, especially, for example, a neighboring country like Pakistan.
ये जो आलात बदल रहे दिन ब दिन अफगानी की जो पाकिस्तानी ज़रूफीज है उसकी कदर बहुत कम हो चुका है हम लोगों ने काफ़ी नुकसान उठाया है क्योंकि कि तालिबान के आने की वजह से इतलात की वजह से पाकिस्तानी रुपये बढ़ गया और अफगानी जो है वो बहुत नीचे आ चुका है
Well, let's get some analysis into the picture. Our guest Phyllis Bennis joins us. She is from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis Bennis is an American writer. She's an activist and a political commentator featured on many television stations. Her focus has been mainly on issues related to West Asia and the United Nations. She's also a very strong critic of Israel and the United States and a leading advocate of Palestinian rights. All right, Phyllis, welcome. Looking at the time that the U.S. actually invaded Afghanistan, the year 2001, up to now, $2.26 trillion to have been spent. The cost of war project at Brown University has calculated that. Now, this investment, if you want to call it that, has yielded a chaotic, humiliating end to America's longest war. What went wrong, Phyllis? Why is the Afghan government failing to deliver on its economic investments that were made by the U.S. or failed to do that and said to be rife with corruption and unfinished projects? I mean, after all, the U.S. spent $2 trillion there. And for what? That is the key question.
I think we have to recognize that the U.S. war in Afghanistan was always a kind of derivative war. It was a war of vengeance following the attacks of 9/11, despite the fact that none of the 9/11 hijackers were Afghan. They were Saudi and Egyptian. But the war was designed partly to keep up the level of tension in the United States, keep up U.S. support for a coming war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis Bennis there. Okay. She obviously says that that was not a democratic exercise when it came to the U.S. At least that's not the way that it went down. All right. Our next piece now takes a look at the reasons behind this war, which was nothing short than a cash machine, especially for military contractors, as you're about to see.
It was one of the most revealing and shocking exposés to cover the U.S.-led Afghanistan war. Bold journalism, numerous testimonials, admissions too hard to swallow, revealing the truth about the Afghan war and the lies behind it. The Afghanistan Papers. U.S. officials constantly said they were making progress. They were not, and they knew it.
Thanks to our military, our allies, and the brave fighters of Afghanistan, the Taliban regime is coming to an end.
For many of you, this will be your last tour in Afghanistan. And by the end of this year, the transition will be complete, and Afghans will take full responsibility for their security, and our combat mission will be over.
To add salt to injury, U.S. government did not even have an idea about the money splurged. No exact accounting done. But why? Maybe this revelation was the answer made back in 2011, which is one of the pillars of the U.S. so-called empire.
Because the goal is not to completely subjugate Afghanistan. The goal is to use Afghanistan to wash money out of the tax bases of the United States, out of the tax bases of European countries, through Afghanistan, and back into the hands of a transnational security elite. That is the goal, i.e. the goal is to have an endless war, not a successful.
Thank you.
The Afghan president described the killings as unforgivable. An American soldier is in custody after a shooting rampage that's left 16 civilians, some women and children, dead in Afghanistan's southern Kandahar province.
A shocking exposé out today in The Intercept reveals CIA-backed death squads in Afghanistan have killed children as young as 8 years old in a series of night raids, many targeting madrasas, Islamic religious schools.
And they dragged the two oldest-looking boys out of that room, took them into another room, along with 10 other older-looking students. But as you already discussed, some of them were as young as 8 or 9 years old.
One of the assets that Afghanistan has, which has become a focus, is its mineral wealth. And one country in particular which appears to have its eye on it is China. Here you see China receiving a member of the Taliban recently. Since the U.S. has now withdrawn itself from the country, China may be looking to back the Taliban with Afghan mining investments. Rare earth metals in Afghanistan were estimated to be worth anywhere between $1 trillion and $3 trillion in 2020. Only hours after the Taliban overran Afghanistan, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said that Beijing was ready for friendly cooperation with Afghanistan. Well, our guest in this section, Marvin Weinbaum, joins us. He is scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. He's also a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and served as analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from the years 1999 to 2003. Also rejoining us is Mohammad Daoud Abadi and Phyllis Bennis. Okay, Marvin, welcome. All those trillions of dollars, Afghanistan's still one of the smallest formal economies on the planet. Last year, President Ashraf Ghani said that 90% of the population was living on less than $2 a day. I mean, if the U.S. gave the money, the trillions of dollars away, the economy would be much larger. Why did this not translate to the Afghan economy?
Well, you know, a lot of it was lost through corruption. There's no question about that. This is something that the Afghans, as well as the international community, has some responsibility for. There were the resources to do far more. But again, I don't want to minimize the fact that there has been change. And along with everything that went wrong, there was a good deal that that did go right.
Only the money that the U.S. invested in Afghanistan went to the people, but it didn't. I mean, Afghans living on less than $2 per day, 90% of them, I mean, that's incredible. What really happened here? I mean, there's aid money also that's involved. Donor conferences have produced billions of dollars in money every year, particularly since the invasion.
The money that was spent by the United States did not go to the people of Afghanistan. It went to a corrupt government that was put in place by the United States and that represented U.S. interests in maintaining their version of stability.
All right. Daoud, corruption, both from the U.S. and the Afghan side. You mentioned some of it before, unfinished projects, for example. We've talked about it. But why didn't the U.S. money and the aid money go to the Afghan people? Let's not forget, billions were given to Afghanistan on a yearly basis. I'm sure you know that. Ordinary Afghans, however, did not reap the benefits. What happened there?
The reason it didn't translate into an Afghan economy was because there was no planning. There was no structure. There was no strategy for spending the money. The money was, in a way, given to all these corrupt officials to keep them keep their mouths shut.
All right. Well,